the Window, a podcast about dining in the South and beyond. I'm Robert Mossy, author of Barbecue, the History of an American Institution.
And I'm Hannah Raskin, food editor at the Post and Courier.
Today's edition of the Window is the good advice edition because I'm going to take advantage of having Tim Carman here in Charleston to solicit him and Hannah for some advice that I need on some upcoming projects. And I think Hannah's going to give us some tips and some advice on how to maybe expand the culinary horizons and find some culinary treats. While we had Tim Carman, food writer and critic of the Washington Post, with us in our studio, we decided to grab him for another topic, which I know you're writing about right now, which is not politics, but barbecue. And particularly, you're here in Charleston working on a story on, or can we say who you're working on? Has it?
Oh, yeah. Okay. Yeah, I've posted various pictures on social media. The cat's out of the bag. Yeah.
This is a secret thing. So you're working on a piece on our own Rodney Scott here in Charleston?
That's right. Yeah.
Rodney just recently got Best Chef Southeast, James Beard Award, which not the first pitmaster to get it, but
the second,
Aaron Franklin of Texas. So two data points now is perhaps becoming a trend. What made you decide to come down all the way down to Charleston and talk to Rodney? What interests you about his story?
Well, so many things. I mean, Rodney came from a very rural area of South Carolina, where there was a very deep whole hog tradition, and you know, obviously, I think the restaurant industry has been grappling with its problem with awarding and decorating mostly white male chefs. And in the last James Beard Awards, we saw a big change in that, as opposed to the 50 best restaurants in the world, which is like a sham. But that's a whole different conversation. And Rodney was part of that. And I think what he's doing, bringing whole hog barbecue, certainly, Robert, you know a lot about barbecue, probably much more than I do. The whole hog barbecue in urban areas is pretty rare. Yeah. And, you know, he's doing it, and I've got a chance to visit his restaurant. And, boy, the pit setup is mm-hmm. pretty amazing. What they're doing to cook whole hogs.
Yeah, it really is. And it took him, I think, quite some doing because it's a lot different than what he does up at, or his family does up at their restaurant in Hemingway, which if anyone's ever been there, it's not really a restaurant, it's probably an imprecise term. It's really a country store, a couple miles out at Brunson's Crossroads outside of Hemingway. And it really just for a long time was a country store where they did various things. I think they repaired cars and stuff like that before his dad started cooking barbecue, and it became a hit. And then barbecue became a bigger and bigger thing. And now it's a barbecue restaurant with a country store attached to it.
Right. But, so Tim, having spent time in the urban interpretation of all of that, I mean, we've already talked about they're going to open in Birmingham. Is it going to scale? How is it going to work?
I think since he's paired up with Nick, and how do you pronounce Nick's last name?
I always say Pahakis.
I'm always like Nick P.
I know. I've been one of, since this is audio, I'm used to writing.
Exactly.
I can spell it.
Yeah.
I think Pahakis is how you'd say it.
Okay.
Pahakis or Pahakis, something like that.
We need to know.
It's a Greek name.
Yes.
So Nick of Jim and Nick's. And as I think most everyone in the South knows, that is a huge chain.
Yep.
I think over 35 locations now, and it just got bought out a couple years ago by a major
big private equity firm. Or at least bought a significant stake in it.
So I think he's now paired up with someone who that's the way he thinks. And I think they've got big plans. Yep. Now, whether or not they can do that and whether or not the country's ready for a whole hog – I think that's the intriguing question because there's not a whole lot of it around.
Right. No, that's really – and so are they committed to maintaining the whole hog? They are. Okay, that's the main part.
And that's Nick's thing with Jim and Nick's originally because Jim and Nick's, they're very proud. They don't have a freezer and they made a big deal about paying their employees better than market wages. And it's his way of trying to scale – quality food, but then take it to a mass market audience. And I think the same thing with Rodney's barbecue, which is I want to do whole hog, but I don't want to compromise and like, you know, do it in some half-assed way, but try to stay true to as true as we can to the tradition while also being able to do it in a model that you can scale.
You know, I went to my first Jim and Nick's yesterday.
Oh.
And I got the pig on a bun. Mm-hmm. And I had to admit, I was ready to hate it, but it was really good.
It's right.
Yeah, it was smoky and it had nice outside brown on it. And I thought,
which
there's
location
nothing
did you go
wrong.
To?
North Charleston.
Great. Yep. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, and they're now like I should say 35. They're all over. I know they're all over the South. I'm not sure how far outside the South Jim and Nick's get, but they've gotten quite broad. And this actually, you know, ties into what I wanted to do, which I need to ask them some advice. So I got Hannah and Tim here both on the barbecue front. I do this as a contributing barbecue editor for Southern Living. I've been doing this top 50 barbecue. It's top 50 barbecue joints in the South. So roughly defined is we include Missouri. So we get Kansas City. We go up to D.C. and Baltimore. So that's about and Texas. So that's our definition of the South. But it's really tough to do the list just to decide. But then there's some more thorny problems have come up. And Scott's a good case of where I'm having trouble, and Sam Jones and others, which is – so there's Scott's barbecue in Hemingway, South Carolina, which is Scott's family. For a long time, Rodney was sort of running the pits there. And then he finally opened up Rodney Scott's barbecue here in Charleston. Now, as you're comparing those, are those the same restaurant? Are they different restaurants? Can you name that? How do you handle that on a top 50 list? Because Rodney Scott's involved in both.
I think they could both be on the list,
yeah,
for sure. Yeah. I mean, you know this from living in South Carolina. It's like the Bessinger problem. You know, it's that those.
Well, that's a little bit different because, like, the Bessingers, you have Melvin Bessinger,
right,
who has two restaurants.
Yep.
Well, it's actually his son now, but mm-hmm. David Bessinger, but it's called Melvin's.
Yep.
There's one in Mount Pleasant, there's one in James Island. They're almost identical. Mm-hmm. I consider that one. Melvin's.
I didn't mean that. I meant that the Bessinger clan,
right,
has spawned.
But then their brother or his uncle has another one, but yes, it's different and similar. You know, that is always a problem.
So I guess what I'm saying is just because there's a family relation between, right, Rodney and his father, I don't think it makes it the same restaurant just because they have the same last name.
I agree with Hannah. I mean, I've been to both now, and it's only once. I'm sure you all have been many, many times, but they're completely different restaurants to me.
Totally.
They have different menus. They have different types of smokers. They use different type of wood. They you know, it's like, yes, they have maybe similar approaches and maybe similar recipes, but they're so different that I would – and they're different
and
ownership.
They're different owners.
Yeah, they're different owners. So it's like they are different restaurants.
Yeah, for sure.
Now, have you – I think you went up to Hemingway during your trip here to visit the original.
I got a ticket, too.
Oh, did you?
Oh,
no.
Boy, I was so dumb.
On Highway 41?
You know, I got a ticket right out of Sweatman's one time.
You know, I should have known. That was my own fault.
Well, I didn't really know how much involvement Rodney's having now with the restaurant up in Hemingway. Is he still
zero?
So he's pretty much just full time here in Charleston,
yep,
and it's his family running the original one. I'd be curious just to, you know, hear your thoughts between the two as an outsider, because I've been eating at both of them for a long time. But
you know, it's interesting. I spent some time with Rodney yesterday morning, and it was a follow up interviews. And then I spent some time in the pit room and saw them, break down a whole hog. So I really wanted to see that process, and it was amazing. So I left there maybe about 1, and I got up to Hemingway around 3. Mm-hmm. And they're open till 6, so I thought I was good. When I got there, they had sold out.
Nothing. That's
and
late.
I was shattered. I mean, and I was – Ella, Rodney's mother, was there. And I was like, not begging, but pretty close to begging. Like, you can't find any
of something.
Right. And,
you
know,
you
so I talked to her for a little bit, and she went back there, and she got me like apparently the last bit of pulled pork. And it was amazing.
Yeah.
I mean, I thought Rodney's was good. This was, you know, and the subtleties of it. I think a little bit more spicy up in Hemingway than it is in Charleston, and maybe that's a city thing. You know, you're trying to cater to many more palates in a big city. But I thought the mix of meats was better too. Mm-hmm. And that's always a crapshoot. I think I understand in putting together a whole hog sandwich is sometimes you get all the different cuts and sometimes you don't.
Right.
Well, it's definitely you get there. The shoulder is different than the ham, which is going to be different than the tenderloin, which is one of the pieces you want to pull out if you're sitting at the pit.
Yep.
But I think some pitmasters try to mix that up really well, so it's all evenly blended. Others, I think you can get big chunks and then little strands and all that. Because that's another thing that what I'm trying to do this year with the top 50 list. In the past, I didn't actually rank them like 1 to 50. I said here are the top 50. I think Daniel Vaughn and Texas Monthly are doing the same thing. They don't necessarily have 1, 2, 3. This time around, I think I'm going to try to do it in order. And one of the reasons for that is that, well, the last time
clickbait.
I did Well, last time I did it, it is that they were running alphabetical order, and everyone assumed that A&R Barbecue in Memphis was my pick for the top.
Right, right.
No, sure. They just start with A. They're in the top 50. They're really good.
Yellow pages trick.
And I tried to do the same where I was going to name the top 10 and then the rest of the 50 or something. But finally, as I said, I just need to rank them. Bite the bullet and rank them. And then, that way there's no confusion by people who think they're in ranked order.
It's an impossible task to rank, I think. But people love it. And, from a readership standpoint, if you rank, people love to click on that stuff.
Well,
and
there's nothing. They just want a number assigned, whatever it is they love or don't love. I remember, I think with Seattle Met is one of the magazines in the city, and they ranked every Starbucks in Seattle.
It's oh my God.
That's quite the task. We're talking about like 500 places, but
ranked every Starbucks
loves
in Seattle? Wow. Yes, that's a task.
But, everyone loves that. They're like, I go to number 214.
Well, that was my second piece of advice I wanted to get from you guys, because I'm still working on this list, because every day I'm changing the orders around. Barbecue's changed, especially all these new places like Rodney's spot. I was in Atlanta just the other day at Bee's Cracklin Barbecue in Atlanta, which is really fantastic. Started in Savannah. This is Brian and Nikki's Furman's second restaurant in Atlanta. But they have a full bar with liquor and everything. They've got, it's different than your traditional Southern barbecue joint. And then if you take a place like a Home Team Barbecue or Fox Brothers in Atlanta, not only do they have barbecue, but they have a full menu. And like Home Team Barbecue has a lot of chefy things and appetizers and desserts. So if you're ranking that top 50, I don't know what I should say. Is it just purely just the barbecue components on the plate? And I'm just really saying these guys cook the best barbecue, which I think is pretty reductive. I'm not going to do that. But how far do you expand beyond it? Do you have to take into account the side dishes? If you have John Lewis doing great Texas-style brisket here in Charleston, am I doing it divorced of the regional context? I'm just doing, and I think that comes up with Rodney Scott's, because his menu here in Charleston is different than what his family serves in Hemingway. He added a great steak sandwich. He had a lot of different sides. I think he serves beer. So if you're saying which one's a better barbecue joint, well, maybe there's more at the Charleston one. So how would you recommend I try to—
Well, sorry, because I think the problem you're running into is what you're looking at aren't even joints anymore.
Right.
When you look at a joint, when
you look at a Buxton Hall in Asheville, which has great barbecue, but it's also, they got pastry chefs. It's a full service restaurant,
Yeah. So is that literally what's entitled 50 barbecue joints?
I can't remember if we call it barbecue joints or restaurants.
But it's not barbecue. It is the place.
I have to go back and look. I think I can frame it however the heck I want.
I think so often Tim and I both review like international cuisines or immigrant cuisine, where it's clear like rule is you don't talk about where it is because it's in as good a place as they can afford, And it's like I would never say like one wall is white and one wall is a different shade of white.
I'm not going to judge the quality of the bathrooms you stretch the imagination.
Well, I don't know. Where do you fall on this?
I think it's a really tough question, because if you take into account like a barbecue restaurant that has a pastry chef and has small plates and has a cocktail menu and does craft cocktails and has craft beer, and you say that's better than Scott's out in Hemingway, so then you're handicapping that place immediately for being what it is.
Right.
So then how do you weigh that? How do you give that the proper weight? And I don't have a good answer for that. That's
a really interesting question.
Yeah, and I think this was raised with Rodney getting the best chef, which is, well, how can you compare Rodney Scott's barbecue in Charleston with the Gray in Savannah, which is a much more of a fine dining, restaurant. Full-service restaurant? And what's a chef mean? So I think it's carrying over into barbecue as well.
See, I do an annual top 10 list in D.C., which is much harder than it would be.
Oh, yeah. So how do you do that?
I only focus on the barbecue. You call it reductive, and maybe it is, but that's the only way that I found that to make it fair is just to focus on the barbecue and not worry. I mentioned the other things, but that's not how I weigh it. I figure if people are going for smoked meats— That's what I'm going to – smoked meats and sides. I'm not going to worry about the craft cocktails.
Count.
The sides do count.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I think the sides have to count.
Yeah.
Because it is sort of like the plate. And particularly if you go to some places, you got the menu. You pick four meats and you pick seven, from seven sides, whatever. But some places like Piedmont, North Carolina barbecue, a barbecue tray is a thing. It's got barbecue. It's got slaw. It's got hush puppies. And if you have really good barbecue, but you can't eat the slaw of the hush puppies, well, then I don't know. That doesn't seem that should get you very far.
Yeah.
And then do you include dessert as a side?
Well, because it's all banana pudding. So then you're in a bad banana pudding contest. Yeah.
Well, but point. Not in your region. You no. see some peach cobbler.
No, there's a lot of cobblers, sure. yeah. and there's like a lot of good pies and yeah. stuff mm-hmm. like that. So no, I don't include the desserts. Mm-hmm. Part of that is when I do these barbecue tours, you don't eat dessert because you'll never eat at the next barbecue restaurant.
This is very true.
Right.
If you sort of just eat a bite of sides and really focus on the barbecue, you can actually eat it more than one or two places. To me, though, I think there is a regional component that is important, which is, and I'm always thinking, is it the top 50 barbecue in the sense that each of these is the absolute barbecue in America? In that case, you're sort of like, you're becoming a barbecue competition where I'm just going to have a one bite mm-hmm. next to each other and line them up. That leads to like a bad place as far as I'm concerned, having judged barbecue competitions. You get numb really quickly to the
fatigue
bite.
Sets in
yeah,
really
very,
fast.
Very, yeah. very fast. I think it's almost like – and then also you get to the same, well, how do you compare a Texas barbecue restaurant against like a Piedmont or Eastern North Carolina barbecue? How can you say this barbecue is better than that? Barbecue is such a different style.
And don't you think that just starts to show your bias more than anything else?
If you really like brisket and sausage, then your top 50 are all going to be in Texas. But if you think whole hog pork is the best, well, then those mm-hmm. would be the best. So I've been trying to balance that out by saying, you need to – if you really like barbecue and all of its regional variants, these are the top 50 places you need to go. So there is some element of – you got to have a Kentucky barbecue restaurant in there because you need some people who love barbecue need to go eat mutton and burgoo because it's really delicious. And these are the best ones. Yeah.
Right. And I guess I'm going to fall on the side of saying you have to incorporate some of the ambiance, even though earlier I may have said something elsewhere. I think sort of the test is, do you enjoy eating barbecue there?
Yes.
And so maybe it's because they gave you a beer. Maybe
it's
because
if you were
like
sitting
walls,
in a white room with a folding table and a styrofoam box, this might be the better barbecue.
Right.
But
if you're telling people to go to these places, you're talking about something that's experiential. Yeah. So I don't think you can grade a place solely on its small plates, even if they have them. But I think you do have to consider the whole and just think, does it serve the barbecue?
Well, that's good advice. I appreciate it. So as I'm refining this list here, I'm having a hard time. It's easy for me to say, here are 50 of the best barbecue restaurants.
Right.
It's really hard to say this one's better
ranking
than that
is
one.
Really hard.
Well, and I think it's changed on how people go barbecue hunting. It used to, maybe 20 years ago, it was just like a bunch of dudes going around.
Yeah.
But now so many people want to explore barbecue that I think you really do have to consider the ambiance.
Yeah.
Like there's only three tables at Scott's, and it's
and
a pretty Spartan
anyway.
Setting.
Yep.
Yeah.
And if you go there expecting it to be a sit-down restaurant, no. It's a country store where you order from a little counter and there's, people are buying – cans of beans and soda around you as well. And there are a couple of tables where you could eat if you want to, but I can only imagine that the vast, vast majority of what they sell
is taken home.
Is takeout.
Yeah.
And they're selling whole pigs that people are taking to parties. I mean, it's a takeout operation where you can sit down if you need to. Well, Tim, thanks for joining us to weigh in a little bit on barbecue and helping
thanks,
with me some of my conundrums.
Yeah, that was fun. I learned some things.
Cool. So I wanted to lead into another topic since we were talking with Tim about, whether you should consider how a place looks and what's around it and what's there besides the food. It reminded me that over the past 2 or 3 weeks, I feel like I've been guilty of putting too much stock in how a place looks.
In fact, you did a top X list of your own. I think it was a top 5 list, right?
Yeah, but I didn't rank them.
You didn't rank them?
Yeah.
Okay.
But separate from that, so that was a list of like places people don't know about.
Yeah.
And so this, though, is places kind of I didn't know about because in too many cases, I feel like I put too much stock in their appearance. And so there's 3 places where I found like amazingly good Asian food for the Charleston area that you would not have guessed from the outside. So I just wanted to mention these places quickly and just sort of, what it tells us about some of the snap decisions we make when we're out looking for something good to eat. So one is I sort of review of Tapio, which is well known as a prominent place in a neighborhood, near downtown, or maybe you would call it downtown, and is well known as a bubble tea provider. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't until this one was maybe a year ago that I ordered off their food menu. I was like, my God, this is great, and so they are doing Thai and Taiwanese street food snacks. And so it's not necessarily the traditional Asian foods that many mm-hmm. non-Asians in the Charleston area, I feel like, are looking for, you know, but we're talking about noodles and dumplings and pancakes, scallion pancakes specifically. And the food is terrific. And the menu is short, but it's really good. And what they told me as I wrote is that only 15% of their revenue comes from food, which is saying something because the food is like three times as much as the drink. So it means no one's ordering the food.
Do they advertise it? Is it Tapio bubble tea? Is that what it says outside? So you wouldn't even know unless you walked in that they had like a whole selection of Taiwanese.
And it's not a whole selection. It's like five items. But they're great. And it is, again, the kind of food that people complain they can't find around here. And there it is at a bubble tea cafe. Really, you know, terrific, terrific, you know, scallion pancake beef wrap. Great. Really good. I had this experience again. I'm over in North Charleston and was in an area that I rarely am. And there's like something that implies there's a Vietnamese restaurant kind of like back behind a corner, which is like what every food writer hopes to find. So I look at it and I think it says Vietnamese on the awning, or maybe it has a whole array of Asian countries up there. You know, it may have well have said like Chinese, Japanese, Korean, you know, it's got them all. I look at the menu and the menu is primarily Thai. And there's a write-up on the wall. They'd been written up, 10 years ago, all their Thai food. But when they hand me the menu, there's a paper insert with nothing but Filipino food on it. And I look around, and there's no one but Filipinos in the restaurant. So it may look for all the world like a Thai restaurant, and it may have been that, you know, it's been documented as a Thai restaurant. This is clearly a Filipino restaurant.
That's interesting. I have so many questions now about the behind the scenes because—
Some of them I can answer.
Yeah, well, because that's been a phenomenon for a long time is that you'd have immigrants from various Asian countries come to the U.S.
That's right.
But open a Chinese restaurant.
Absolutely.
Because, you know, no one wanted to buy Korean food at
right.
the time.
Right. It's like the old Seinfeld show, right? Yeah. It's like, you know, it's like.
Okay, what was the country he
what
was
country
from?
Is he from? Pakistan? There's Pakistani food everywhere.
Well, I think it evolved because I think there was a time where a lot of Korean families would come and open Chinese restaurants because people sort of knew Chinese food.
Yep.
They didn't know Korean food. Mm-hmm. But now Korean food has really taken off in the past 10 or 15 years. And so you can have a Korean barbecue or a Korean restaurant and people will come to it.
Right. This is true too for many Filipino immigrants who would open Chinese restaurants. And so the hint is, I don't know if everyone knows this, if the, you know, if the word Oriental ever appears in a restaurant. Oriental means Filipino.
Oh.
Yeah. And that's true in the name of a grocery. Often it's like Oriental Grocery. That means it's Filipino oriented.
Oh, that's interesting. And I realize, as you say, I really know very, very little about Filipino food, though I did stumble into a great Filipino dining experience in Seattle. Mm-hmm. We're just looking for breakfast and we were staying downtown and there's this place called Ludi's Diner. Mm-hmm. And I saw the diner. I mean, I was kids. The kids love, you know, pancakes and bacon eggs. And it looked all like that. But you go in, it has a menu that looks every bit like your typical classic American diner with pancakes, omelets, bacon and eggs. And in the corner, there's Filipino breakfast. And it's like these sausages. And and I ordered the Filipino sampler breakfast. It was absolutely wonderful.
Yeah. And I mean, I there are some great Filipino cookbooks out there if you're not familiar with Filipino cuisine. There's one, I think it's something called like 10,000 Islands or something like that. But it's a fantastic cuisine because it takes in the influences of Asia where it's situated, but also everyone who's occupied them. Mm-hmm. So,
and definitely there's an interesting sort of secession there of who's – Who's
oh, that
been
got
in,
handed
in,
over. I mean, if you remember from like 19th century, you know, your American history class, like that's there was a lot of the whole Spanish American War involved the Philippines. So, so it's kind of American. It's kind of Mexican. It is delicious, and it does involve quite a bit of bacon and egg. So it's really it's great for breakfast. And actually, in fact, this restaurant we're talking about, I was there for breakfast. It was so good. So that was great. Again, totally unexpected. And then the third
What is that one called?
I'm sorry, that one's called Mai Tai.
I see.
And so what?
But it's Mai Tai with a little Filipino.
Well,
in
it
the
is
back.
Now. So what had happened was it was purchased by a longtime server there. She was Filipino and it used to be a Thai restaurant. And she decided not to change the name or menu. She didn't want to lose regulars or I'm sure all the printed material they already had. But it is a Filipino restaurant just kind of living in the shell of a still active Thai restaurant.
Well, before we leave that one, because I was be curious to learn a little bit, because again, I'm just I'm now curious to learn more about Filipino food. What was it spicy or not?
The food that you had? I ordered was, I'm accustomed to Filipino food enough that it was like, this is what I expected. Mm-hmm. You know, I can't really gauge the spice level. It seemed appropriate for what I had ordered. Yeah. I don't know. You know, it always has like a peppery contingent. There's always, you know, you can always make it hotter.
Yeah, the stuff I had for breakfast, mm-hmm. it was lumpias, which is sort of like a spring roll type of fried thing. And then I think it's longanizas or
sausage.
Sausage, mm-hmm. Which is sort of a reddish sausage. But I was surprised by it. I thought at first it might be spicy. It wasn't spicy at all. Mm-hmm. It was very savory and flavorful, but it had a very Polynesian character to it.
For sure.
And sort of that sweet and sour kind of – a lot of that going on. So I was just really impressed by it.
It is delicious.
Yeah. So I'm all in. And now I'm going to have to go check out – you said it. I forgot
already.
Although
I think for you, I'm going to be now in like the Filipino restaurant concierge. Prescription business. Yeah. I want you to go to Luz's in North Charleston. Luz.
Is that L-U-Z?
L-U-Z, apostrophe S. It is a real dive. I mean, a real dive. So everyone there other than you will be drinking themselves to death and like playing the scratch-off lotto. But Luz makes a fantastic adobo, and it's terrific. So last place I wanted to talk about, which to me was maybe the greatest surprise of all, I think I may have mentioned this on the show earlier, which is that the owner of Miyabi, the mm-hmm. hibachi chain.
We were talking about the hibachi restaurants in glowing terms a couple of episodes ago.
Right. And he had told me to try their sushi. I kind of blew him off for a while. And then I recently went to Miyabi and had the sushi, and it's the best sushi in Charleston.
Really?
Yep. Oh. Yep.
So there are these places in Charleston. I won't name names because they're good, but you can basically drop the price of a mortgage on a plate of sushi with gold leaf wrapper and all this kind of stuff on it.
Either.
No, they're okay, but they're not the kind of things you'll remember, you know, for the rest of your life.
Well, this sushi is great. And I never would have thought that the best sushi in Charleston was in a Japanese steakhouse, nor would I think that anywhere else I go. So anyways, moral of the story is food is not always where you think you're going to find it.
Now, did I ask you? I can't remember if I asked you this when we were talking about Japanese steakhouses or not. We were talking about how much of the staff, the cooks, were from Micronesia.
Yes. Uh-huh.
Is there Micronesian cuisine that might make its way into the steakhouse? Would that be fish, maybe?
It would be fish. I don't think I. You know,
because I know they don't have steak in Micronesia.
Yeah, I don't think that's gonna. I don't think there's any call for it. I mean, I think sushi got developed because sushi was trendy, and they thought like that was a market they could serve. But again, it is Miyabi is owned by a man from Japan who takes sushi seriously, and he hired a chef from Kyoto. And I mean, the only thing it's kind of jarring if you're accustomed to sushi in a more traditional sushi setting is the pieces of fish are beautifully cut, and they're cut exactly, you know, on the with the grain just the way they ought mm-hmm. to be. They're enormous. Like, it's like the kind of the piece of fish is like wrapped down the side of the rice. It's kind of like hanging off the rice, like a blanket of fish.
So this is not one you go pick up and eat in one bite.
That's the thing. Yeah. I had always learned there's always that debate, like, about are sushi chefs being sexist or just upholding a wonderful tradition when they make rolls smaller for women because we have smaller mouths. Because the idea is that sushi should be consumed in one bite. One bite, they always say. It's like if a sushi chef speaks any English, it's usually one bite, one bite. This is not one bite sushi. And so it's like, but it's okay because the fish is great and it's really fairly priced. So that's definitely that part of the aesthetic is not what you would expect if you're, you know, trained in Japanese culture. But the rice is on point. The rice is great. The fish quality is great. Anyways, I'm thrilled because I've been looking for good sushi for years. So
I guess you did point out, look for the Oriental. That's a flag that it's going to be a Filipino restaurant, or at least mm-hmm. a Filipino family.
Can I tell you one more thing along those lines? Yeah. I don't know if everyone knows.
Well, I just wondering other tips that you have, like other than just eating at every place you see that is a hole in the wall and hoping you find something great. Are there other tips for how to filter out and find them? Yeah.
No, but I think, okay, yes. I mean, I suppose the tip is, on all three of these examples, is listen to what people are telling you mm-hmm. and look at the people around you. You know, I mean, if Tapio is serving this food, they must think it's good. Like, give it a shot. You know, I think it's just be aware of, be be in the moment, to be, as you know, to take another like
Asian
idea.
That certainly was the secret for me at Ludi's, because we went there because we were all hungry for a big breakfast. We had a big day coming up. And it just was very jarring to see a little box of Filipino breakfast specialties against all this other thing. And you might say that's weird, but if they have a whole box, there must be a reason.
It's there for a reason.
That it's there.
And so I think the takeaway is don't get distracted by what's on Yelp. Don't even get distracted in this case by what's been written in the newspaper. I mean, this was written up as a Thai restaurant. And it is true. It was a Thai restaurant. But restaurants like people evolve. And this one has evolved into a Filipino restaurant. You know, just because everybody at Tapio is getting bubble tea doesn't mean you can't get the curry. So I didn't get to tell my other secret about naming conventions. I don't know if everyone knows this.
No.
That in Vietnamese restaurants, that when it says like Pho 76, that's always the year that they immigrated.
Oh, I didn't know that.
I learned that from another food writer. I know, but there's often a number in the name of a Pho restaurant, and that's the year that they came to the country.
That makes sense. I've noticed that before. I'm always like, that's not on Highway 76. So why is it called
Pho 76? Right, exactly. And then you start to write, it's like, why do I never see like Pho 66 or whatever, you know, as you say. It's like, it has to do with immigration patterns.
So you probably won't, you might.
We're going to start seeing.
You probably won't see a Pho 23 for a while.
Right. We got, however, 5 years from now.
Well, that's an excellent tip. Now I know.
Yep. That's all for this edition of The Winnow. We recorded today's episode in the Pho 16 podcasting studios at the Post and Courier building in downtown Charleston, South Carolina. If you enjoy listening to The Winnow, please help other listeners find us too. Just go to iTunes, SoundCloud, or wherever you download your podcasts and like us or leave a rating. The Winnow was a production of the Post and Courier and Palmetto New Media. Our producer today was the highly ranked J. Emery Parker.
Very highly.
Our theme music is by the Bluestone Ramblers.
Until next time, I'm Robert Moss.
And I'm Hannah Raskin.
Now get out there and eat.